Welcome, everyone. Thank you for attending session 352, titled The New God Argument. Our next presentation is sponsored by the Mormon Transhumanist Association. As technology accelerates cultural upheaval, Mormon transhumanists champion prophetic visions of human potential. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A. Engaging in the Q&A portion of this session following the remarks of the presenter. We invite all here to participate practice looking at all Mormon experiences as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they may be. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. So that's by the door off to the, when you go out, off to the right. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars, and consider supporting the various vendors outside. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenter to keep within that framework of so that we allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session, you clear the room and speak outside so presentations can begin presentation for the next session. About the presenter, the New God Argument is a logical argument for faith in God. Given assumptions consistent with contemporary science and technological trends, the argument proves that if we trust in our own superhuman potential, that we should also trust that superhumanity probably would be more compassionate than we are and create our world. Because of a compassionate creator, may qualify as God in some religions, trust in our own superhuman potential may entail faith in God, and atheism may entail distrust in our superhuman potential. Lincoln Cannon is a technologist and philosopher and leading advocate in technological evolution and post-secular religion. He is a founder, board member, and former president of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. He is a founder and board member of the Christian Transhumanist Association, and he formulated the New God Argument, a logical argument for faith in God that is popular among religious transhumanists. Lincoln is CEO of Thrivus, the human enhancement company. He holds degrees in business administration and philosophy. He is married to Dorothy. Okay, sorry. I'm like, I didn't want to mess it. I didn't want to mess up the accent. Dorothy Von Kriekonch. And they have three children. So, and now please join me in welcoming Lincoln Cannon.
It's a big step. All right. So I'm going to pull a chapter out of Blair's book and invite all of you backseat people to come sit up here at the front. The reason I'm inviting you to come up is that I'm going to be talking about some complicated things. And if I don't interact with you during that discussion, then there's a good chance that some or all of us will get lost along the way. This is going to be a very, very nerdy discussion. Nerdy in all the best ways, hopefully.
Don't be shy.
Yes, please don't be shy. So in that spirit as well, I know that it's pretty typical for people at Sunstone to kind of wait until the end, ask their questions. If you get confused by something in this presentation early on, please raise your hand early on, because the concepts that we're talking about are going to build on each other.
If you get acknowledged for raising your hand, please go up to the microphone because, like I said earlier, this is being recorded, and we'd love to hear and preserve your questions for posterity for when Lincoln answers them. Thank you.
Yeah, and alternative to that, also, if it's a short question, which hopefully they really will be questions instead of a long diatribe, I can repeat it as well if it's short enough for me to remember the whole sentence. All right, so the new God argument. The new God argument is in a family of arguments that people have used for millennia to bolster faith in God. Most of the arguments that you have probably heard of before are arguments that attempt to prove the existence of God. And that is not what this argument is about. This argument is not about proving the existence of anything. This argument's not an ontological argument. This argument is an argument that's intended to persuade you that you should have faith in God. All right? An important thing to know from the very beginning. And also from the beginning, I want you to know how this relates to me personally. And there's probably only one person in this room who recognizes this picture other than me. It's my mother who's sitting up here at the front. So don't say anything mean about me today because you'll hurt my mother's feelings. But before I say something personal about me, I want to know a little bit more about you. So I'm going to ask some questions before I share my faith transition story to make sure that I'm speaking to you in ways that make sense to you. Because at Sunstone, one of the things we celebrate is faith transitions, right? Sometimes those faith transitions are away from God, away from a religion. Sometimes those faith transitions are back to God and back to religion, and my story is about both. So I want to ask a few questions and get some audience participation. If you'll join me in that, I'll appreciate that. So first question is, how many of you are right now atheists? One? Only one dares to admit it? How about agnostic? Okay, heavy in the agnostic area, atheist agnostic. How many of you identify as Mormon? Raise your hand. I think that's almost everybody except for maybe some film crew people, which makes sense. How many of you identify as transhumanist? Got some wafflers and lots of yesers and a few no's. All right, so I am a Mormon. I'm a transhumanist, and I have been an agnostic, and I have been an atheist, and I have been a theist, and I am presently a theist. Not atheist. Theism is my perspective on God. And I began as a little guy playing with leaves on the campus of Brigham Young University. You can see the dorms there in the back. And that's because my mother and father met each other at Brigham Young University. My mother went to BYU because, and she of course could tell the story better than me, but I have the microphone, so I'm going to tell it. She went to BYU at kind of a dare from her father because she was Catholic and she wanted to become a nun. And her father was a non-practicing Mormon at the time, but still thought maybe highly enough of the church is the right way to put it, that he thought that it might keep her from becoming a nun. So he said, I bet if you go to BYU, you won't become a nun. She said, ha, right. She went to BYU. She became a Mormon. She didn't become a nun. And I'm here. Nuns don't make babies usually. So I'm happy that my grandfather encouraged her to go to BYU and to avoid becoming a nun. Not that I have anything against nuns. They seem generally like good people. But I'm glad that my mother's not one of them. So at BYU, she eventually met my father. They got married at BYU. We lived in Utah for a little while, moved off to Illinois for a while, moved off to Washington State for a little while. And through these periods of time, my parents taught me Mormonism from, you know, the time I was this age onward. And two of the things that stick to my mind most prominently about the way that they taught Mormonism to me were from my mother, an emphasis on the practical side of faith. Faith without works is dead. She seemed to like James from the New Testament a lot. And that, you know, that's how I was raised. Religion is about doing something. It's not just about thinking nice thoughts. It's about doing something about those nice thoughts. And then from my father was a programmer, and this was a long time ago. So it was before the internet, before becoming being a programmer was a popular thing to be. And my father taught me to appreciate science and technology, and he never demonstrated even an ounce of concern that there was any possibility that science and technology were incompatible with our religion. It was just a non-issue. Science and technology were part of the real world, religion was part of what we lived, and they worked together. So I grew up thinking that way. Why should there be any problem about compatibility between science and religion, between technology and spirituality? There shouldn't be a problem. There isn't any problem in our lives. But then eventually I would encounter people, of course, that expressed complications between the two. And because they're compatible, well, you know, as my mother taught, why shouldn't we be using these things, right, as an expression of our faith? So that's the kind of Mormonism that I was raised with. I was raised with a practical Mormonism that was consistent with, you know, not having anxiety over science and religion. As I entered my early teenage years, my father, before my early teenage years, he had cancer the first time, but he got cancer the second time when I was a teenager, and I started having to think harder about mortality, particularly in this case, the mortality of my father, who I loved, but also that started to make me think about my own mortality. And it started to encourage me to look outside of the Garden of Eden that I had grown up in and think about the suffering in the world, the limitations of what we know, the limitations of what we can do, and this great big black wall of death running at all of us. And it started pushing me to ask some difficult questions. I also, as I became a teenager, I was somebody who enjoyed very much reading and studying and asking hard questions. My father, I love this about him. He gave me access very early on as a teenager to, this is going to sound very primitive to younger people, but we used to get these CDs or even pre-CD forms of data, of storing data, and put them in our computers, and we would do search databases on our computers of all of the scriptures and authoritative Mormon references from like the Journal of Discourses. We called it info, it was branded Infobases at the time. So as a young teenager, I had access to more information about my religious tradition than the leaders of my church probably had at that time. Most of them weren't computer literate. Most of them weren't using databases to research our history. So I started to develop a really good sense of the challenges of Mormon history before most of the other people who were my age and before most of the other adults at that time. And it moved me to ask questions that were uncomfortable for a lot of people. To their credit, my parents never asked me to stop asking those questions. I remember a conversation with my father. Excuse me. One time we were sitting in the driveway. We just got out of fast and testimony meeting. And I told him I thought everybody was lying about what they knew. And he didn't get mad at me. He just said, well, why do you think that? And I said, well, they're saying all these things they know about everything. And I don't know hardly anything about all that stuff. And they seem to want me to claim that I know it all. And there's a lot of pressure about that. Dad, what do you know? And he answered me very honestly. He said his answer, and it doesn't matter whether any of us agree with his answer or not, this is his answer, and it struck me as genuine and sincere at the time. He said, well, I don't know a lot of things, but one thing I'm confident of is that there's a God and that he loves us. That was his answer. And I was kind of, you know, at that point in my life, I was starting to develop a sense of skepticism towards God that wouldn't reach its culmination until years later. But I appreciated that he was willing to have that conversation honestly with me. So I eventually went on a mission, and I went on a mission in faith. I sat in an MTC room with other missionaries who were telling me what they knew, and it got around to me in the circle, and I said, well, there's not a lot of things I know, but I have faith in these things, X, Y, and Z things that I talked to them about, and I'm going because I think that sharing these things with other people will help them live better lives because it's helped me. And so I did that. While I was on my mission, there were some signs that my father's cancer would come back. I got home from my mission, and he got cancer the third time, and he was dead within a couple of years. During those same couple of years, I was going back to school. I was trying to start a career. I got married, had my first child. Life was pretty stressful. And that's already the kind of thing that early adulthood is a time when lots of people go through changes. They question what they've received. Very typical. On top of it, having my father die kind of like really sped that up quite a bit. Problem of evil became a serious issue for me. Not that that's unique at all. How many people have dealt with the problem of evil and become atheists? That is a very long list. So, yeah, I was there. It contributed substantially to me losing my faith in God. My father's death being one of the heaviest straws on that camel's back. So this was the late 90s. My father died in 1998, and I was married, had a child. I joked with my friends that I was agnostic about any extraterrestrial humanoid deities. That's the socially appropriate way that I tried to express my atheism. And they were kind and laughed, and we talked about it. I finished up a philosophy degree in 1998, and one of the philosophers who really grabbed my attention was William James. William James is a pragmatist philosopher, and one of the things that he focuses on is the moral justification for risking, for taking risks, intellectual risks in particular, but risks of all sorts. And so William James advocated this idea that sometimes there are kinds of worlds that we want to live in that actually require that we take the risk, that we actually act on our hope for that kind of world, because there's all kinds of things that we don't know. And if we wait around for perfect knowledge before we act on those things, then we actually might undermine the realization of those things that we hope for because we won't work on creating them. And I encountered William James and read a lot of William James during the late 90s, and his ideas started to have so much influence on me, and I appreciated them so much that I ended up naming my second son after him, and in kind of a complex way. So I have a grandfather whose first name is William, another grandfather whose first name is James, and now my middle son's middle name is William James, and the order was determined by my favorite philosopher. So that's just to give you an idea. That son was born in the year 2000, and the homage to my grandparents was important. No less so was the homage to this philosopher and the influence he was having in my life at that period of time. Pragmatism became hugely important, and here's why. I still loved what Mormonism had given me. I still loved the idea that we should become compassionate creators. I still loved the idea that we should reconcile with each other and love each other, even to the point of suffering and dying for each other if necessary. I still loved the idea that there should be a community of people that should reconcile with each other, work together to build Zion, to create celestial glory. I had become persuaded that, the God out there wasn't out there at this point in time. That's where I was at. But that didn't mean to me at that time that I should stop caring about those things that had motivated and inspired me from my childhood. And a strong influence in that area was William James and this idea that it's worth risking for things that we really care about. And so he helped me do that. While I was exploring ways of risking for things that I really cared about, how do I go about you know, what can I really do to bring about a better world? What can I really do to make a difference? What can I really do to make Zion, to contribute to making Zion? Because that's something we all have to work on. It's not just me. But what can I do? You know, faith without works is dead. Even if God doesn't exist right now, faith without works is still dead if God doesn't exist right now. What can I do? And so I searched. And now, fortunately, I didn't have to go use InfoBases discs anymore at this point in time, because this is late 90s, and the internet was a thing. And so what I did is I got on the internet, and I did lots of searching, and I found lots of cool things. And one of the cool things I found is represented by this fellow up here on the screen. His name's Ray Kurzweil. And Ray Kurzweil is a famous inventor. And, you know, you might have heard of the Kurzweil keyboards, very nice synthesizers. And they were super popular back in the time when I was in high school. I loved techno music at the time. I still appreciate it. But back in the time, techno music was really cool. And I thought it was great that he had made those. But what interested me more about Ray Kurzweil was that he was promoting some other ideas about our ability, our potential to use technology to pursue the kinds of visions that I had been inspired with as a child. Now, I was already totally set up for this worldview, right? I was already totally set up for the idea that we could use technology to greatly improve human abilities, greatly enhance human communities, and pursue these utopian visions of human potential. I was primed for this by my parents, a practical kind of faith. Science and technology are good things. These things go together. And so I read these ideas from this guy who's telling me, listen, technology is advancing at an exponential rate, he said. We'll take a little picture of that. It's advancing at an exponential rate, and it's having profound effects on our biology, and even more so in the future, it's likely to have profound effects on our biology, and it's having profound effects on our culture now and probably even more so in the future. And we could channel these effects towards enhancing our bodies, our brains, our relationships, and our world to be something vastly better than what we currently know, beyond present notions of poverty and enmity, beyond present notions of suffering and death. It may be possible for science and technology to contribute in really tangible, concrete ways towards pursuing these Mormon visions that I had inherited as a child. And I loved it. I realized that, you know what? This guy is talking about things in a way that I've always kind of thought about, but he was giving words and explanations and providing data and trends and more substance to things that had always inspired me. So I started researching more about him, and I discovered a whole network of people advocating these kinds of ideas, and they called themselves transhumanists. And as I got to more and more familiar with these people, I decided, you know what? I've always been a transhumanist, not in name, because here I am, a young adult. I just discovered this word. It's really cool. Lots of cool people engaged in this thing. But in function, I had always been a transhumanist. I had always just considered science and technology to be some of the things, not all of the things, some of the things we should be using to make the world way better than it is right now, to make our bodies and our brains way better than they are right now, to make our relationships way better than they are right now. And so I followed up on that. I started talking with transhumanists, networking with them, going to conferences, and becoming more acquainted with their ideas, and discovered huge resonances between my hopes and aspirations and my background and theirs. And so I decided that I would identify as a transhumanist. Core to the transhumanist ideology is an assumption, and I call it the faith assumption. Most transhumanists don't call it this because they're not, by and large, religious people. Most transhumanists are secular. I call it the faith assumption, and it's a simple assumption, and it's the assumption that humanity will not become extinct before evolving into superhumanity. Transhumanists have this idea that human evolution is not complete. It's been going on for a long, long time. Earth's been here for 4.5 billion years. The universe has been here for 13 billion years. Single-celled organisms developed into multi-celled organisms, developed into more complex life forms, and eventually humans evolved. Yes, I'm that kind of Mormon. I believe in evolution. Still do. Did then. Did now. I did when I was a child before I had encountered any transhumanists. Evolution never caused problems for me. And if we believe in evolution, that it's happening, that it has happened, that there's substantial evidence for it across the spectrum, from divergent points of evidence. This is not just one point of evidence. There's lines of evidence for evolution that converge from all the different domains of science. If we've been evolving, which we have been, why are we going to stop? Why should this now be the end? So, if this isn't the end of evolution, then where are we going? What are we becoming? What do we hope to become? And transhumanists, our answer to that question is, well, we should try to become superhuman. Or some of them might call it posthuman, or some of them might call it transhuman. There are different words for it. We're going to call it superhuman for our purposes today. And how do we do that? Well, for most of our history, we've been evolving kind of haphazardly, randomly maybe, because some of us live long enough to have children. We pass on some characteristics to those children. Those children, if they're smart being defined in terms of whether they survive or not, live long enough to have children, and they pass on their characteristics. But something has changed. Culture emerged. Technology emerged. And suddenly there was this feedback loop where what we intentionally do starts affecting our biology. Agriculture changed humanity biologically, and it still is. Culture changed humanity. Technology is changing humanity, and that's not going to stop. But what is maybe different now than in the past is that we're becoming more and more intentional about it, and our tools are becoming more and more powerful. And that doesn't mean any of this is necessarily good. It's powerful, and it's changing. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. So transhumanism, then, is the ethical use of technology, or advocacy for the ethical use of technology, to enhance human abilities. Ethical being a key word here. We recognize that technology is not always good. Applications of technology are not always good. It's not inherently good. But if we deliberate and consider how to use technology, then our hope and our trust and our optimism is that humanity can use it ethically and survive its challenges, serious challenges, we'll talk more about those in a minute, and risks, long enough to become more intelligent, longer lived, healthier, more compassionate, more like this ideal of superhumanity, hopefully a holistic ideal that we aspire to. Not just faster, stronger, smarter, but also more loving, better relating, better communities. So that's the faith assumption. And this is the very first assumption of the New God argument. Any questions about this first assumption? Maybe we should clarify some words. Humanity, we're talking biologically. We're not talking about ideological definitions of human. We're just talking about Homo sapiens, the species. Intelligence, the capacity to achieve goals. Superintelligence would be an intelligence that's greater in every way than its evolutionary ancestors in intelligence. That would be a superintelligence. Post-humanity is an evolutionary descendant of humanity. And so superhumanity, we're just combining the words superintelligent and post-humanity, smushing them together and saying that's what superhumanity is. So that's what transhumanists want to become.
So one quick question on the on superintelligence. Are you quantifying how much greater that intelligence has to be than that of its evolutionary ancestors at this point?
Good question. No, not necessarily. Okay. You could be a superintelligence as long as you're smarter than your evolutionary ancestors in every way. You supersede them. So it's possible that humans in general are superintelligences compared to our most early human ancestors. It's possible. I don't know how we would quantify that, but it becomes clearer and clearer the more you diverge in intelligence. Other questions about the faith assumption? The whole argument that I'm going to be providing to you, this is a logical argument, this is a chain of logic, is going to depend on this assumption. So if you have any questions about it, happy to try to clarify. All right, let's go on. The risks of superhuman. I warned you we were going to talk about the risks. Transhumanism is not just technological cheerleading. It is not. So many times people want to criticize transhumanists for being a bunch of people who are naive, think that that technology is going to magically solve all of our problems and make an egalitarian utopia tomorrow. No, come on. I mean, we're not stupid people. We saw what World War II did with technology. Technology can do some really bad stuff. So what do we do about that? Well, we try to solve the problems. This is Elon Musk, and Elon has something to say to us that I think is true. And it might be surprising, but the biggest threats facing humanity going forward are probably not nuclear weapons and probably not even global warming, although both of those are serious threats, and I don't want to undermine the importance of us solving those problems. We should be working on solving them. But I'm of the camp represented by Elon that has deep concerns about the potential for superintelligence, artificial or otherwise, going in really, really bad directions. So Elon's quote here, "I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I were to guess at what our biggest existential threat is, it's probably that." And I agree with him. I think it probably is that. Now, that doesn't mean that we should all drop our concerns about all the other things right now and only focus on artificial intelligence research. No, we shouldn't do that because we have a portfolio of challenges and risks facing us. We should take a portfolio of approaches to mitigating those risks. So, for example, in financial theory, you invest all of your money not in just pets.com. You put some in pets.com and you put some in Amazon, and then 20 years later, half of your money made a gazillion dollars and half of your money went to zero, right? Something like that. Well, same approach to mitigating the risks of human civilization, facing human civilization. You're going to invest some money in natural risks, like how do we stop an asteroid if it's going to come and hit the planet? And you're going to invest some money and time and research into artificial risks, like how do we manage nuclear weapons? How do we manage global climate change? And some research, money, and time into how do we manage the risks of computational technology as it becomes increasingly powerful and approaches what people commonly call artificial intelligence. Elon's not alone. Here's another well-known technologist. You'll know his name, Bill Gates. He's the founder of Microsoft. He says, "I am in the camp that is concerned about superintelligence." This is part of a much longer quote where he goes in more depth, but he too is concerned about this risk. Here's another person that you might recognize who's concerned about the threat that artificial intelligence and superintelligence presents to us. That's Stephen Hawking. He says, "I think the development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race." Here's another guy you might recognize. His name's Sam Harris. Now, curiously, Sam is one of the four horsemen of the new atheist movement, right? So this is a hardcore atheist. He's given the name to atheism. And what does he say? Talking about technology, talking about what we're doing in the work with artificial intelligence, he says, "We have to admit that we are in the process of building some sort of God." This is a guy who spends most of his career saying there are no gods. "We have to admit that we are in the process of building some sort of God. Now would be a good time to make sure it's a God that we can live with." I agree with him. It is a good time. So let's do some nerdy stuff, really nerdy stuff. And if I lose you on this, raise your hand, ask the question, please. We're going to talk about some philosophy of artificial intelligence. And we're going to start off with a hypothesis that's called the orthogonality hypothesis. I'm sorry, it's an ugly word. But the word orthogonal means that two things are not statistically related. That you cannot predict one variable based on the other variable. That one variable can be X, and it will say absolutely nothing about how you should predict variable Y. Y could be anything when X is whatever. So the orthogonality hypothesis is the hypothesis that the level of intelligence, how smart something is, whether it's a human or a non-human, the level of intelligence is orthogonal to its final goals. In other words, you and I and none of us can predict someone or something's final goals based on how intelligent it is. That's the orthogonality hypothesis. We cannot predict final goals based on level of intelligence. So Some people have tried to argue in the past, well, clearly really smart things will be really kind because they're smart, and being kind is smart. That's actually not true. It just isn't true. Smart things aren't always kind. Really smart beings on our planet have done some of the most horrible things in human history. Humans being pretty smart compared to non-human animals, and yet we've done some really terrible things to each other. So there is no relationship. There's no relationship between intelligence and final goals. That's the orthogonality hypothesis. And guess what? It's wrong, in part. I'm going to tell you why it's wrong in part in just a second. But it's still important. Here's how it's wrong. There is some relationship between the two. Some relationship, and here's why. A very simple anatomy, let's call it, let's say, two bits in a computer, two on-off switches in a computer, can only have a certain level of complexity in the final goals that it even has. So there are certain kinds of goals that two bits cannot have that a human can have, because your brain is loaded with billions of neurons. You can have far more complex goals than two bits on a computer can have. So I call this the semi-orthogonality hypothesis, and that's the acknowledgement that there are physical constraints to goals. Physical constraints and also practical constraints. For example, you might choose to have a goal to kill yourself. This happens among humans, and this happens among machines, not in the same way as it happens among humans, but I can program a computer to do things that will turn its program off, or that will even run the robot off the cliff, and then the software will stop functioning, right? Because it kaboomed on the ground. So there are constraints on the relationships between goals, complexity of goals, and complexity of intelligence. But despite that relationship, in general, there is a huge expanse of possibility of the relationship between level of intelligence and goals. The more intelligent something becomes, the less predictable its final goals become. And that's the salient point behind the orthogonality hypothesis. You cannot predict what superintelligence is going to want to do. You cannot, based simply on the fact that it's superintelligent. And when you can't predict things, they become dangerous, very dangerous. So, please.
Can you predict, as you get towards superintelligence, can you predict things it won't do? You just can't predict what it can do?
Maybe to some extent. So the question was, as you get closer to superintelligence, can you predict things that it won't do versus things that maybe it would do? And there is an extent to which the answer is yes, and we're going to talk about that. It's called the convergence hypothesis. But I want to emphasize that it has little to do with the fact that it's super intelligent, that it becomes predictable. It has everything to do with what we're going to talk about next, which is convergence. No matter how intelligent you are, you need resources. No matter how weird and unknown and divergent your final goal might be, you are going to have to use resources that other people want to use to achieve their other weird final goals, no matter how divergent those goals are. Here we are on this pale blue dot with limited resources. No matter how divergent our goals are, we all need to use the same resources. And so we converge. This is called the convergence hypothesis. The convergence hypothesis is that despite the fact that we have very different goals, despite the fact that we can't predict what those goals would be based on level of intelligence, we can predict instrumental goals. We can predict that in general, things are going to try to survive because the ones that don't try to survive have already eliminated themselves. Or they don't live very long, so they're less concerned. Unless they go out with a big boom. That really sucks. But we can predict also that they're going to try to use resources to achieve whatever their final goal is. And so the convergence hypothesis is actually, you might be thinking, oh, this is a good thing. No, this is potentially a really bad thing also, because it means that the paperclip manufacturing algorithm that becomes super intelligent is going to try to pursue its goal of manufacturing paperclips at the expense of the carbon in your body. It's just trying to maximize its achieving its goal. You have carbon in your body. There's no bad feelings. I'm just pursuing my goals. Nothing against you personally, but you're made of stuff I can make paperclips out of. Nice ones, carbon fiber. Nice paperclips. So the convergence hypothesis actually is the recognition that instrumental goals converge because we need to share resources. And so, despite all of our different final goals, we have converging instrumental goals, and that puts us into a situation where we have to bump into each other. How do we bump into each other? What happens when we bump into each other? Well, lots of different things happen. Sometimes that bumping into each other results in what I'll characterize as conquest. Sometimes that bumping into each other results in what I will characterize as cooperation, maybe even compassion. What tends to influence us to go in the direction of conquest versus the direction of cooperation? The argument goes that we tend to go in the direction of conquest when there are power differentials and power is centralized. So when I confront somebody who's vastly more powerful than me and I have carbon that it needs, it usually doesn't ask my permission. It takes my carbon. Why should it bother asking? It's like irrational for the paperclip manufacturer. Asking, who cares? Nothing I can do can harm the super intelligent paperclip manufacturer. So it takes the carbon. I die. Nothing personal. So when there's great imbalances in power, conquest tends, it's not necessarily the case, but tends to be the way that an intelligence will go. On the other hand, when power is decentralized and when I can turn off the paperclip manufacturer because I have enough power to do that, but I like paperclips, so I want it to produce some paperclips in the right way, well, then we work out a symbiotic relationship. We start trading. We start cooperating. So where power is decentralized and where there aren't huge power imbalances, things start to head in the direction of what I call cooperation. Now, an interesting thing about cooperation is that as our power increases while simultaneously becoming more distributed, the level of cooperation required to refrain from killing each other continues to increase. And so cooperation at the limits of power starts to become the limits of cooperation. And the limits of cooperation, I'll suggest to you, are practically indistinguishable from compassion. You can't tell the difference. In fact, that may be what compassion is the practical limits of cooperation. How are we doing so far in human history? Well, I mean, lots of bad things have happened. But in recent years, as you saw on a slide I shared a few minutes ago, technological power has been increasing vastly and quickly. We have never had even close to the kind of technological power that we have today. And even two, three decades ago, we now dwarf the amount of power, technological power, that they had at that time. So technological power has been increasing quickly, and per the convergence hypothesis, that presents a challenge because where there's lots of power, there's going to be lots of opportunities for conflict. Are we destroying each other? Is the world getting worse? Is the risk of violence, the risk of conquest increasing? Well, as it turns out, there are some trends that should make us optimistic. This is one of those trends. This is worldwide income from 1800 to present. During the period of 1800 to present, technological power has increased exponentially, unfathomably, practically. And during that same period of time, worldwide income has increased dramatically. The fact that we haven't destroyed each other yet, that we haven't totally eradicated all but a singleton, that there's not just like one dude who like totally owns the rest of us, that probably explains why world income has increased as well as it has. Because we have, to some extent, not perfectly for sure, to some extent managed to decentralize power And what are the results of that? Well, we've been forced to cooperate. We've been forced to decentralize and forced to give things out and forced to trade a little bit. We see this also in longevity. Since 1800 to present, human longevity has increased considerably over the same period of time that technological power has increased exponentially. And one more example, violence has decreased substantially, especially in the most technologically advanced and educationally advanced areas on Earth, Europe being a great example. This is the homicide rates in Europe from 1300 to present. Why did I show Europe and not the rest of the world? Well, records aren't very good going back that long anywhere else in the world except Europe. Of course, not even in North America. So Europe is a great example of what happens as we introduce cultural and technological change, and as we manage not to silo it, but to distribute it, homicide rates go down. We are forced to cooperate more because the level of power is going up and we don't centralize it. Therefore, what's the solution? If power gets really high and we don't centralize it to one singleton who can thump the rest of us, well, because we all have power, we're forced to cooperate more. And when we cooperate more, we kill each other less. And the trends suggest that's what we're doing. There's a great thinker, his name's Steven Pinker, who's written several very interesting books, notably The Better Angels of Our Nature. I'll refer you to that. And Steven Pinker does a very in-depth study of human history and describes how violence has been decreasing. He says here, the decline of violence is a fractal phenomena visible at the scale of millennia, centuries, decades, and years. What's interesting to me about that is that so is technological power and decentralization of technological power. They, too, are a fractal phenomena. We have been increasing in technological power and decentralizing technological power in a fractal way on a scale of millennia, centuries, decades, and years. So we've become more cooperative. And Steven Pinker would argue we've become more compassionate. Our concern with human rights has increased vastly compared to the past. Are we done? Do we have, or, you know, can wash our hands, no more work to do? No, of course not. We have a lot of problems still confronting us. But in many ways, by many measures, things have gotten better. And we should acknowledge both our successes and our failures. In this case, we're acknowledging some successes. The reason I'm acknowledging these successes right now is because they point to a trend. They point to the trend that when technological power increases, as long as we keep it decentralized, we can predictably expect increased cooperation. And this is at the heart of the compassion argument. This is the second step of the new God argument. Number one is a really nerdy formulation of everything we've been talking about. It basically says, the first thing, either humanity will probably become extinct before evolving into superhumanity. So we might go extinct. We might use our technological power to kill ourselves. Right? Kaput. Or superhumanity probably would not have more decentralized power than humanity has. That's a way of saying, listen, superhumanity will either not really be very super, or it will condense all of its power into a singleton. All that power will go down to, like, one great robot, something like that. We call it a singleton among transhumanists sometimes. Or superhumanity probably would be more compassionate than we are. That is the first, that's an assumption. That assumption is based on the kind of reasoning that I've shared with you so far, related to the orthogonality thesis, the convergence hypothesis, and this sense of game theory where if we can keep power decentralized, intelligences of various varieties and levels will tend to cooperate as long as we can keep a good power balance. The second assumption in this argument is that superhumanity probably would have more decentralized power than humanity has. This is an assumption. It might not prove true. This is an assumption that might be a little bit like the faith assumption, where it's something that we might actually have to work toward realizing. But if it's true, if the faith assumption is true, if it's true that we will not go extinct, and that's something to work toward, by the way. We shouldn't just say, oh, we're not going to go extinct, obviously. No, we could, but let's work against it. Let's have trust. Let's have faith in that idea. Let's work toward it. And number two here, if superintelligence will decentralize its power, if those things are true, then logically, in the possibility space, the outcome would be that superhumanity probably, this is a probabilistic argument, would be more compassionate than we are.
Is there a good reason to think, too? Like, is there some preliminary reason to think that would be?
Yeah, so the question is, for the recording, no, you're fine, absolutely, I don't mind repeating it. The question is there some good reason to think that superhumanity will maintain decentralized power? The best reason I have to offer you right now is our track record so far, which is not a perfect track record, but remember the trends. The trends are all going in a good direction. We are distributing income much more broadly than before. We are distributing longevity better than before, education better than before, civil rights concerns better than before. Was there ever an animal rights movement in the Middle Ages? Not that I know of. So we're even getting beyond our species better than before. Are we perfect in any of these areas? Not by a long shot. But because there is at least already some extent of decentralized power, which isn't perfect, but some extent of decentralized power, it's moving us towards a need for greater cooperation as our power goes up. And I think that we need to continue fostering that decentralization of power, because if we don't, all bets are off. Superintelligence, whether it's from a box, a computer, or from human integration with computers, will become unpredictable and dangerous, and we're going to be in for probably a nasty future. So that's the compassion argument. The compassion argument is basically, if the faith assumption is true, that we won't go extinct, and if the second assumption is true, that superintelligence will decentralize power, then the third thing follows. Superintelligence will be more compassionate than we are. Compassion argument. Any other questions on that? All right, we talked about the risks of technological advance, of artificial intelligence, of superintelligence. What are the opportunities for superhumanity as we increase in technological power? One of the cool things that we're doing today, this is technology that exists today, of course, and maybe some of you have experienced it, is virtual reality. You can go and you can buy some cool glasses, put them on your head, and you can go into a world that you can interact with. You can virtually touch things, and they can respond to you. I played a recent virtual reality game where there were, like, I don't know if they were demons or goblins or something. They were coming out of the walls, and I was shooting them with a laser gun, and they would die. I saved the world. I felt so awesome. And so virtual reality is something that's here today. And if you did anything with virtual reality 10 years ago and compared it to today, you will know that our capacity in this area has improved dramatically over the last 10 years. And it's going to get even better. It's going to get a lot better. So that's one area that we're working on is virtual reality. Can we make it more immersive? That's one of the cool things that we could do with technology. Why? Why do we even care? Well, it's fun, first of all. If you had not done it, try it. You probably will have fun. But there's also a lot of great things that we can do with it that are more practical than just having fun. For example, a doctor who lives in New York can put on VR goggles and do an operation on a patient in Ivory Coast, Africa, where my son just left on a mission 3 days ago. And do something that nobody in the Ivory Coast is trained to do. That's pretty cool. That's, you know, more than just having fun. And virtual reality technology could make these sorts of things more accessible. Another really cool thing that we're working on is brain emulation. And this can get kind of scary, just so you know. But we're going to talk about it. Brain emulation. There was a 10 to 15 year project of mapping the human genome that was completed a few years back. And it was a really cool project, super expensive project. To map the first human genome cost us, what was it, billions of dollars? I don't remember. It was a lot of money. You know how much you have to pay today to get your personal human genome mapped? You can do it today for a few $100. You don't have to be a billionaire anymore. Thank goodness. You can get it done for a few $100. So there was this project to map the human genome. We've mapped it many times now. We're really good at mapping the human genome, and it can now be done inexpensively. We're still working on interpreting it, right? We can map it, but we don't understand everything it's doing. That was a tough project. Now, there's another project similar to it that has already started, and it's called Mapping of the Human Connectome. The connectome is the pattern of our brain, the human brain. And this project is a little bit more complex than the human genome. In fact, it is at least two orders of magnitude more complex than mapping the human genome. We've got billions of neurons in our head, and they're configured in three-dimensional arrays. If you go back and you look at your DNA, they're in a nice little line, lend themselves much more to mapping than the human brain does. But we're working on it, and we have new tools, and we're getting better at scanning in real time, and we're learning about the human brain. Now, it's possible that at some point we will be able to map the human connectome, like we have done the human genome. It's possible. Maybe we'll fail. Maybe we'll have a nuclear war tomorrow and human civilization will collapse and we won't ever get there. But current trends suggest we're probably going to get there at some point and we'll map the human connectome. Well, one of the things we're doing with the human genome right now that we've mapped it is we're working on interpreting it. We're emulating it in computers. We're now using CRISPR to change it. Guess what we're going to do with the human connectome when we know it, when we can integrate with it? Well, we're going to start emulating it in computers. We're going to start making changes, not just scanning it, but also injecting information into it, having it be a two-way communication. There are companies working on this already. Neuralink, which was announced by Elon Musk, is producing a brain-computer interface that should have 10 to 100 times better resolution than current brain-computer interfaces, notably the Utah Array, which Mormons helped develop, which is, I think, the only one that's FDA approved right now, if I remember correctly. Anyway, Elon Musk just announced another one that his team is working on that will have 10 to 100 times better resolution than the Utah Array. Brian Johnson at Kernel is working on a competitive product to that for brain-computer interfacing. The initial applications of these technologies will be to help people that have problems with their brains. It's the usual approach that medical interventions start with. But that's not the final application. There are other applications as well, including enhancing human relationships and enhancing human experiences that these brain-computer interfaces will enable. As those tools get better, they will help us map the human connectome better. We'll get better models. Those models will become increasingly dynamic. And it may become possible at some point in time to emulate a complex human brain within the body of a computer. These are not disembodied brains, by the way. No such thing as disembodied brains. All brains have bodies, including emulated brains. Bodies are a little bit different than ours, still have bodies. One theory of mine in philosophy is that mind, consciousness, what we experience, is substrate independent. It's the term that they use in philosophy of mind to describe this. And what they mean by that is that mind is not dependent on a particular substrate. It still needs a substrate, but it's independent of any particular substrate. That substrate could be our carbon, but it might also be silicon. And so it potentially, if this theory of mind is correct, these brain emulations that we create could be conscious, could be sentient, could be persons like you and me, not disembodied persons. That's a mischaracterization of the idea. We're talking about brain emulation. Their brain would just have different substrate than what you and I currently have. Brain emulation. We could take this up a notch, too. When we have really immersive virtual reality technology and when we have great brain emulation technology, what if we took those two technologies and started doing some ancestor simulations? And we've been doing family history for a long time, right? And our models of our ancestors have been getting a lot better. They started out with drawings on a cave wall, but then they progressed from drawings on a cave wall to maybe video and audio recordings. I have video and audio recordings of my father. He's been dead for 20 years. I have recordings of him. They've now progressed to the point where we can now also take biometrics and simulate our ancestors to some extent or another. And it's kind of interesting to watch a simulation of somebody that you knew and loved. There was a great simulation of, I think it was it Picasso? At a museum? Some well-known artist. I don't remember. Who was it?
Dolly.
It was Dolly. That's right. It was Dolly. At some museum. Do you remember which museum it was? Anyway, where people could go and interact with, used his voice, used his mannerisms. They emulated Salvador Dali, and people had this experience. What would it have been like to interact with this really cool artist?
So my question, just to make sure that I'm tracking, is so have you heard of the 3D holograms that the Shoah Foundation at USC has been doing?
No.
So they take Holocaust and other genocide survivors and film them when they're alive.
Oh, wow.
And they have, like, the whole dome with cameras. And it the interview is, like, really lengthy and really, really in-depth. But then they process it through a computer software that allows for that person's interview to interact with future viewers.
What a great idea.
So say we did it with you. 50 years from now, 100 years from now, someone could come to Sunstone and ask you based on this, the recording of this session, and the computer in seconds would find where you talk about something similar to what the question is asking, and your hologram would speak to the...
Yes.
To the viewer.
Yes, you are tracking perfectly.
Okay, so I wanted to make sure that that's essentially, you know, that's what we're talking about as far as ancestor simulation, but as is happening right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're working on this already.
Okay.
Now, an interesting thing, we're already working on this, and we're already producing it to some extent. Remember the other two technologies that we were just talking about, full immersion, virtual reality, and brain emulation.
Mm-hmm.
Given a certain theory of mind, these ancestor simulations will be more than simulations. They're simulations for right now. But given a certain theory of mind, these ancestor simulations will be more than simulations. They will be ancestor computations. They will be computing, providing a brain substrate for sentient persons who are our ancestors. Now, this is a controversial idea. But if a certain theory of mind is correct, then when we emulate those brains, you can interpret this in multiple ways. Either the spirit will be in that brain or it will be attracted to that brain. I don't know how it works. How does the right spirit get in the right body when a mother conceives the embryo? I don't know how the spirit gets there. I'm not telling you how you have to think about it. But whatever God does to get the right spirit in the right body at conception will need to happen. And why can't it happen when we emulate brains of our dead ancestors? And so one of the reasons we might do these ancestor simulations is to get beyond the point of simulation and actually engage in resurrection. Controversial idea, but some transhumanists, such as myself, take this very seriously. That's right.
Like our descendants have created a simulation that we are now participating in, and we are their ancestors, and we are essentially resurrected in that sense, I guess. What is the Mormon transhumanist take on that argument?
Funny you should ask. Perfect introduction. Thank you. So the question was, what's the Mormon transhumanist take on Nick Bostrom's idea that he calls the simulation argument, that we might already be living in one of these ourselves? So let me tell you. Before I tell you, though, let me bring everybody on board with what the simulation argument is. So the simulation argument is, first of all, the recognition of these technologies I just told you about. It's the recognition that we are developing full immersion virtual reality technologies, we are developing brain emulation technologies, and we are running ancestor simulations. We are doing all of these things today. We're working on them and pursuing them to varying degrees of implementation today, and good reason to suspect that they'll likely get much better in the future. So what are the philosophical ramifications, if they are possible, as one theory of mind suggests to be the case, if they're possible and if we attain them? What are the philosophical ramifications? Well, Nick Bostrom, in an article he published in Philosophical Quarterly back in, I don't know, it was around the year 2000, if I remember right, He presented and this is the most famous version of the simulation argument. There's actually older versions too, but his is the most famous and probably the best developed. He argued that if we go forward to create many simulations, computations, because they might not be simulations anymore, computations of our evolutionary history, then statistically, think about this for a second, statistically, we almost certainly already live in one ourselves. And he arrives at this conclusion by taking into account instances of subjectivity. So if you take all of the instances of human subjectivity that have ever existed, and let's say we create 32, magical, statistically significant number, computed worlds in the future, each of which have, let's say, 10 billion computed humans in them. What are the odds, if you're just a randomly selected human out of all of the human worlds that we know of, the 32 that we know we created in a computer, and the one that we are not sure about? What are the odds if we take one random person out of there, that that person comes from a computed world? Very, very high. Let's say we do this 1,000 times, create 1,000 emulated computed worlds with sentient persons in them. Every bit as sentient as you and me. But we know that they're in computed worlds. Well, his reasoning basically is, once we've created a sufficient number of computed worlds, we're probably living in one ourselves. We should probably assume that we're also living in one, just based on statistics. So that's the simulation argument. The simulation argument is either we're not going to go on to create, compute many evolutionary simulations, computations. We're not going to go on and create many of these, or we almost certainly already live in one ourselves. That's the simulation argument. So you either have to decide it's probably not possible, or we probably will choose not to do it for some reason, or we're probably living in one ourselves. Simulation argument. Any questions about that? I'm going to give the Mormon take on it in a second.
My question is, in the Mormon transhumanist or just general transhumanist, or even just in this particular argument, philosophical argument, how does the earlier, diagnoses of walking corpse syndrome play in? Which is, it's the syndrome that a psychiatrist coined about people walking around feeling like they're dead, like they don't exist, but are existing.
Yeah, so I maybe this is related to the philosophical concept of the zombie as well. The notion that there's people who we recognize as sentient persons who themselves don't feel like they're sentient, and maybe there are people, conversely, the zombie, who, or maybe there are people that don't appear sentient to us that are. So it could be two-sided. How many of us can prove right now that I'm sentient? Yeah. None of you can prove I'm sentient. I might be a super sophisticated hologram being projected from super intelligences in Alpha Centauri here to confuse you. And I really don't have any feelings. I'm a robot. You can't prove otherwise. I'm sorry if you think you can. You're wrong. But what's interesting, I think, is that it shouldn't matter. You should probably treat me the same way either way, right? Sure. There are some interesting moral dynamics about how we should's a big word, but how we should interrelate with each other. And this gets back, again, to the compassion argument that we were talking about earlier. The chances of me hurting you if you start to try to conquest me are higher than if you try to cooperate with me, even if I am absolutely devoid of consciousness. So on a practical level, you have every reason to treat me like you would like to be treated yourself, unless you're certain you have the power on your side. And then you can treat me like a robot, maybe. But that's the point of the compassion argument, right? Is that we should be trying to cultivate a distribution, a decentralization of power. So the simulation argument is this idea that either we will not go on to compute many evolutionary histories, or we're probably already living in one of those computed worlds ourselves. This is Nick Bostrom. Belief that we will one day become post-humans who run ancestor simulations is false. unless we are currently living in a simulation. Elon Musk again. You guys know who this guy is. He's in the news all the time. If in case you don't know, this is like the owner of Tesla. Owner's not the right word. Founder of Tesla. He's the founder of SpaceX. He's behind the Boring Company. It's not boring as in, like, no fun. It's actually a play on words. They're making things that bore underground to make tunnels for trains and stuff. Anyway, he's like the real-world Tony Stark, right? If you don't know anything about him, look him up. He's fascinating. Really, I really am impressed by him personally. Anyway, he says that if civilization stops advancing, that may be due to some calamitous event. So maybe we should be hopeful that this is a simulation. So think about his reasoning here. He's a techno-optimist. He thinks that we can do a lot of cool stuff with technology. Therefore, he thinks it's probable that these trends that I've talked to you about, virtual reality, brain emulation, ancestor simulation, they're going to continue, and that we have at least theoretically the possibility of achieving them. And if we haven't, if we don't ever achieve them, it's more the explanation for not achieving them is that we've destroyed ourselves, not because they're not possible. This excellent technologist is confident they're possible. The question is, will we get there? So his reasoning here is we should probably hope we're living in a simulation, because if we're not, that means that it's likely we're going to destroy ourselves, because it's likely that whoever could be simulating us or computing us, computing is a better word, because we're not talking about fake things, destroyed themselves before they got around to computing us. That's his reasoning. Here's an interesting person. You'll recognize him as another one of the four horsemen of New Atheism, Richard Dawkins. He says, science fiction authors have even suggested, and I cannot think how to disprove it, that's the key here, that we live in a computer simulation. And this is a quote from his book, The God Delusion? So he's talking about all these reasons not to believe in God, and yet in the middle of his book, he has this really interesting passage where he says, well, as it turns out, there's one kind of God I can't figure out how to disprove, and it's ones running ancestor simulations. Even the greatest of atheists don't seem to have the ability to refute this idea. Here's another atheist, Sam Harris. And Sam Harris, when he encountered the simulation argument, he concluded this: statistically, therefore, it is more likely that we are simulated ancestors. Now, he was just reasoning based on the probabilities that I mentioned to you a few minutes ago. Here we have two hardcore, well-known atheists who, when confronted with the philosophical argument that we call the simulation argument, concluded we're probably living in a computed world. Here's another atheist, Neil deGrasse Tyson. I want to get the likelihood that you think we are in a simulation. 10% chance? He says some other things, and he gets back here. He says, I think the likelihood may be very high. Again, another pretty hardcore atheist, hardcore science, popularizer, recognizing the strength of the simulation argument. You asked about the Mormon take on the simulation argument. Well, here's the unique Mormon contribution to the simulation argument. The simulation argument remains true and valid and a strong logical philosophical argument independent of the creative mechanism. If you don't think we live in a computer, that's okay. The simulation argument still matters, and here's why. The logic is just as strong if you think that humanity will go forward and terraform many worlds that emulate our evolutionary history. The logic is just as strong if you think that we'll go forward to the future and cosmoform many worlds that emulate our evolutionary history. If you think that we're going to go on and create many worlds similar to the ones that we come from, then we almost certainly live in a created world. That's the statistics. And we call this the creation argument. So what we've done is we've abstracted the simulation argument that focuses on computation. And by the way, I think a hybrid of computation and cosmoforming is pretty persuasive, my personal take. But it doesn't really matter. The argument remains strong no matter what you think a viable creation mechanism may be for creating many worlds in the future that emulate our evolutionary history. If you think that humanity will go on to do that, then you should conclude that we're already living in a world that was created by superintelligence with those capacities that you expect we will have in the future. So that's the creation argument. It starts with number one here: humanity will probably become extinct before we evolve into superhumanity. So maybe we'll go extinct before we get this capacity. Or superhumanity probably would not create many worlds emulating its evolutionary history. Maybe it's not possible. Maybe that theory of mine is false. Or maybe they will choose not to for some bizarre moral reason that they're able to enforce, which would seem to imply a singleton that could enforce it across all of humanity, which has some nasty, unethical ramifications, I think. But if one of those things don't happen, if we don't go extinct first, or if there's not some hurdle that we can't get beyond technically or institutionally, then the conclusion is, or superhumanity probably created our world. So number two, this other assumption, superhumanity probably would create many worlds emulating its evolutionary history. Like the faith assumption, this is something that maybe we should work towards. Maybe we should care about creating emulations of our evolutionary history. Why? Well, I'll tell you one reason I care. I want my dad to live again. If he's ever resurrected, that is an emulation of my evolutionary history. He'll be back. I don't know how he'll be back. Mormon scripture talks about having more robust, more intelligent bodies, but those same bodies that we had somehow changed. I want him back. So there's my motivation. And I kind of project that motivation to others. You lost somebody you love. Don't you want that person back? Great. Well, then let's work on this together. Maybe we can do something. Maybe God has shared with us, by grace, some tools, some means that we can participate in this work together. That's my faith. So, if we make those assumptions, the conclusion is, if we think that we can go forth and do these creations of worlds and emulations of our ancestors, if we think we can do that, given the tools that we've been graced with, then we should conclude that we're probably already living in a created world, based on the logic of the simulation argument generalized to any feasible creation mechanism. Before I go on to that, any questions about the creation argument? That's right. Against all odds.
Against all odds. Isn't that interesting?
So, yeah, for the recording, Randy's...
Is there a God at the end of this film? Not yet.
That's right. So for the recording, I'll repeat what you were saying, Randy, so it's not lost. Randy was calling attention to Ray Kurzweil, who, when confronted with this argument, suggested, well, there has to be a first, and we're the first. And my response to that was, against all odds, right? So Ray Kurzweil is very optimistic about all of the technologies I've described to you. He does think that we're going to go on and have these capacities. And yet, for some reason, he thinks that we're probably the first. Probabilistically, he is almost certainly wrong. I love Ray, but he's being real bad at statistics on this one. That seems far more hypothetical to me than the realization of the statistics involved in the beginning.
Because he wants his dad almost as bad as you want him.
He does. Again, great. So Randy commented again for the recording that Ray Kurzweil, one of his motivations is that his father died. And he's interested in these kinds of technologies too. And yeah, I have that in common with Ray. I think a lot of people have that in common with Ray. We've lost people we love. And there's seems to be an opportunity to do something about that. Yeah. And I respect Ray immensely for what he has done to cultivate interest in pursuing that idea. He's influenced me deeply. Other questions about the creation argument? So here's the magic. When you've done two logical arguments, you can combine them together with the word and magic happens. So we can take the compassion argument and the creation argument and their conclusions, and what we get is the God conclusion. Based on the other assumptions we made, based on the argumentation, based on the logic, here's the God conclusion. Both of these things are true. One, superhumanity probably would be more compassionate than we are. Right? That's the compassion argument. Two, superhumanity probably created our world. That's the God conclusion. So we made five assumptions. Those assumptions might not be true, but we might have moral and practical reasons, pragmatic reasons, to make them true. And if they are true, if those assumptions are true, then this is the conclusion. This is the deduction. This follows logically from those five assumptions. If those five things are true, this also is true, no matter what Ray Kurzweil thinks. Superhumanity probably would be more compassionate than we are, and superhumanity probably created our world. What does Richard Dawkins have to say about this? Richard Dawkins is an atheist, right? He wrote a big book on why we should not believe in any gods. But he made a big honking exception right in the middle of his book. A big honking one. Here's what he says. There are very probably alien civilizations that are superhuman to the point of being godlike. Now he goes on to say a little bit more. This is in the God Delusion that he says this. He says, why are they godlike and not gods? Because they weren't always gods. They evolved to become gods. Well, but hold on, Richard. You just said that there are no gods that we should believe in. Have you ever met a Mormon and not like just like straw-manned them to death and listened to them long enough to hear what they have to say about God? Because their God wasn't always God. Just like you're claiming, Richard. He doesn't know that. Maybe he'll stop by and talk to us someday. So he makes a big honking exception right in the middle of his book for the God that Mormon theology advocates. And the God, by the way, that transhumanism advocates. Here's another atheist. Michael Shermer is the founder of Skeptic Magazine, very influential atheist, and here's what he's said. He said, I would like to immodestly propose Shermer's last law. Any sufficiently advanced extraterrestrial intelligence, ETI, is indistinguishable from God. And he goes on to describe this at length and saying, hey, hold on a second. So in the Christian tradition, they attribute omnipotence and omniscience and all these omnis to God. And he's saying, you know, it's practically this extraterrestrial intelligence that we're talking about, this super intelligence, he's thinking it's extraterrestrial. I'm telling him it's coming from here in part. It's probably out there too, right? Because creation argument. If we create it here, it probably created us. That's the creation argument. He's only looking out there. Shouldn't be looking here too. He's saying that any sufficiently advanced ETI is indistinguishable from that omni-god. Because you know what? We're stupid compared to artificial superintelligence or natural superintelligence. We're stupid. There is no practical distinction from Shermer's perspective between an almost omni or a better than me omni to the point that I can't recognize the difference than the real absolute omni. And I'm not much of a Platonist. I think omnis are nonsensical personally. But his point as an atheist is that practically there's no distinction between the two. If there's a God that became God versus a God that was always God, it's the same thing. Question?
And the irony with all these guys is they're extra hard on Mormonism compared to every other religion. I'm just like, they're closet Mormons and don't know it.
Yeah, I would like to think that too. That the statement was, these guys are closet Mormons and they don't know it. I think they get carried away. So Sam Harris once made a really stupid, I actually like Sam Harris. I don't really like Richard Dawkins. I think he's a jerk often. I like Sam Harris, but one time he made this really silly comment. I think it was Sam who made this. That, we can objectively say that Mormonism is more stupid than Christianity because it takes all the stupid things of Christianity and adds more stupid things to them. What he failed to recognize is that Mormon's interpretation of Christianity makes some common stupid interpretations of Christianity less stupid. Anyway. All right. Sam, we'll get to Sam. Sam Harris actually has encountered the simulation argument and the Mormon version of it, and he wrote a blog article about this. You can look it up. So he wrote a whole blog. I'm just taking out one sentence of it. You should read the whole thing. Anyway, he says, we may in fact be living in a world in which Jesus will return, our descendants might engineer specific religious doctrines into their virtual worlds. And what's the example of the religion he thinks that would do this? Mormons. So Sam Harris comments in this blog article, if you read it at more length, that this is the one God argument that has given him pause. The one. And that's I take as a high compliment, because this is one of those guys who's gone around bashing every God argument he's ever encountered, most of them by appeals to ridicule because they really don't merit more than that from many atheist perspectives, the militant, hardcore new atheists. And yet there's one that gave him pause, and that is the simulation argument combined with a Mormon approach to it. Go read the blog article. So the question is, are these atheists right? Does superhumanity qualify as God? Does it? Are we just talking about something different? Or are we talking about the real thing? Is this what God is? Well, let's go to the authority for Mormons to start out with, Joseph Smith. God himself was once as we are now and is an exalted man. I am going to tell you how God came to be God. This is from the King Follett sermon. He goes on to say, listen, a lot of people have supposed that God was always God. He says, no, I'm going to refute that idea. And I'm going to tell you how God came to be God. So from the beginning of the Mormon religion, with Joseph Smith, we have already established in our theology this idea that God wasn't always God, just like Richard Dawkins would point out. You know, it had to start somewhere, had to come from somewhere, had to do something. Well, Joseph Smith agrees. And I want to parse, let's see how much time we have.
5 minutes.
We have 5 minutes. I don't want to too carefully parse. I want to mention a few things from the scriptures. First of all, the glory of God is intelligence. Okay, we've been talking about super intelligent post-humanity. Our scriptures explicitly associate God, an essential attribute of God, with intelligence. Man was also in the beginning with God, intelligence. Scriptures also associate humanity with intelligence. Abraham 3, there's two facts that exist. Where there's two spirits, one will be more intelligent than another. So intelligences progress according to Mormon scripture. DNC 130, whatever level of intelligence we attain to will bless us, not only now, but in the future. Because maybe when our brains are emulated, they'll start out with the same level of intelligence we had. We have to recognize each other when we get started, right? DNC 76, well, what do these lesser intelligences become over time? They become gods. These intelligences become like this other intelligence, this super intelligence. Humans become something more than human. They become exalted. Humans, post-humans, superhumans. And how exalted do they become? Well, they become equal in power and in might and in dominion. You've got to learn how to be gods yourselves, the same as all other gods have done before, Joseph Smith says. There was a war in heaven. Think about the convergence hypothesis. Conflict over resources among superintelligences. What happened? What were they fighting for? Well, as the story goes, one was fighting for agency, and one was fighting for a singleton to control everything. Okay, which one wanted to control everything? Which one wanted to be the superintelligence that would be unpredictable because there was no power decentralization, because there was no need for consent? Satan, in Mormon theology. Right? Which one advocated for an idea of decentralized power? Which one advocated for sharing in suffering together, sharing in risk together, sharing in glory? The glory of God is intelligence together. Right? We are supposed to be joint heirs in the glory of God, says Paul in the New Testament, if so be that we suffer with him. So think about the compassion argument and the importance of maintaining equilibrium in power. Our theology is all over this. So the new God argument consists of four parts. First, the faith assumption, we won't go extinct before becoming superhuman. Second, the compassion argument, superhumanity probably would be more compassionate than we are. Third, the creation argument, superhumanity probably created our world, and then you mush them together with the magical word and. If the creation argument is true, if the compassion argument is true, then superhumanity probably would be more compassionate than we are and probably created our world, and that qualifies as God, at least in Mormon theology. So according to this argument, if you have trust in these secular ideas, these technological trends, these things that reflect the best of contemporary science projected into the future with unknowns, but if you trust in these things, if you want to work towards these things for even a secular future, you cannot do so coherently without also trusting in what qualifies as God in Mormon theology. And that's the new God argument.
we probably have about 30 seconds for any additional questions.
Just that one scripture you mentioned that was rattling around in my head about us becoming God in the way that it's always been done. If God is indistinguishable from this superhuman you're talking about, in the past, I mean, they clearly there were generations of gods previously, and presumably they weren't using the kind of technology that we would be to become godlike. So how do you square that?
Okay.
Does my question make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. So if they weren't using technology, how did they become gods? Well, my answer would be, do we have any reason to suppose they did not start with technology like what we would recognize as technology? There's a fascinating statement that was made by a science fiction author on one occasion, which was that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. I would extend that and say any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from divine power. We are living in a world of invisible technology already. There are waves invisibly carrying information to this computer at my desk. Because we don't see it doesn't mean it's not there, right? So I guess my answer would be, I don't know how God became God in a process. But God seems to have, assuming God exists, which I trust is the case, then God seems to have graced our world with means for following a similar path. And I trust we should use those means to try to follow that path.
So it was some kind of tech. It's just not the same tech in generations.
Might be very similar. And I also want to emphasize that it's not just technology that makes us God, right? Technology is going to destroy us if we don't use it compassionately. And that's emphasized in the new God argument.
Well, this session is generously sponsored by the Mormon Transhumanism Association. Transhumanism takes the Mormon idea that humans should become gods and the transhumanist idea that we should use science and technology in ethical ways to improve our condition until we attain post-humanity, or superhumanity in this case, and suggests that these are related, if not identical, tasks. That is, we should ethically use our resources, including religion, science, and technology, to improve ourselves and our world until we become gods ourselves. Please visit the Mormon Transhumanism Association booth across the hall to meet with a representative, join, and or learn more about Mormon transhumanism. And if you all would join me in thanking Lincoln for his presentation, that's the end of the session.